This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Let me introduce the panel and then we'll get started. To my immediate right is Matthew Dowd. Matthew has a long history of working in politics for both Democrats and Republicans. He began his career working for former Senator Lloyd Benson in Texas. He later worked for Texas Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock. In 1999, he changed parties, and in 2000, he worked as a senior strategist in the Bush campaign. In 2004, he was the chief strategist for the Bush reelection campaign. More recently, he has expressed some misgivings about the Bush administration. Last year, he told the New York Times, for instance, that he was disappointed in things, and we hope to get him to talk a little bit more about his feelings about the Bush administration tonight. He's also a founding partner of ViaNovo, an international communications and brand positioning firm. He's been named Pollster of the Year by the American Association of Political Consultants. He was the chief strategist here in California for Governor Schwarzenegger's reelection campaign in 2006. He teaches now at the University of Texas LBJ School of Public Affairs. He serves as a political analyst for ABC News. And he's the co-author of a best-selling book, Applebee's America, How Successful Political, Business, and Religious Leaders Connect with the New American Community. To Matthew's right is David Kennedy. David is a professor of history at Stanford University, where he teaches 20th century American history, American political and social thought, American foreign policy, American literature, and the comparative development of democracy in Europe and America. He's written many books. Let me just name three. His 1970 book, Birth Control in America, The Career of Margaret Sanger, helped to pioneer the emerging field of women's history. His 1980 book, Over Here, The First World War and American Society, used the history of American involvement in World War I to explore the American political system, economy, and culture early in the 20th century. And in 1999, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Freedom from Fear, the American People in Depression and War, A History of the Great Depression and World War II, and I might add, a wonderful book, which I've read. He's received many awards and honors, including the Francis Parkman Prize, the Bancroft Prize, and he's been a Guggenheim Fellow. To my immediate left is Lynn Sweet. Lynn is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times, where she writes both a column and a blog. She has covered politics and government from Chicago's local politics, a good training ground, to the White House. This year she's been covering the presidential campaign, particularly the Democratic campaigns, and she has been particularly involved in the coverage and a leading figure in the coverage of the Obama campaign. She's a regular guest on MSNBC and other national political programs. In 2006, she traveled to Africa to cover Senator Obama's visit there, the visit that produced a well-known picture of him in African dress. You may have seen that. In the spring of 2004, Sweet was named a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics at the Kennedy School of Government, and she led a study group on the 2004 presidential campaign. She's also covered the Middle East. She broke the story on the perks the Clinton White House offered to major donors. And in 1990, she was one of the earliest journalists to begin analyzing ads, political ads, for accuracy, now quite a common practice. She's a former president of the Washington Press Club Foundation, a member of the Gridiron Club, and I might say also she's particularly well-educated in that she's an alumnus of Berkeley. For that, you should applaud. And to Lynn's left is Byron York. Byron is the White House correspondent for National Review, where he has written on topics including the presidential campaign, battle over the president's judicial nominations, the war on terrorism, the anti-war movement, and the business histories of the president, the vice president, and their Democratic critics. He is also the author of a 2005 book, The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy, which examines the role that the newly energized left, as exemplified by MoveOn.org, Fahrenheit 9/11, the Center for American Progress, and others, did play in the 2004 presidential campaign. He's a weekly columnist for The Hill, a newspaper about Congress, I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, and has written for the Atlantic Monthly, the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, and the American Spectator. Like Lynn, he has appeared on many national television programs, including Meet the Press, Hardball, and others, and he contributes occasional commentaries to National Public Radio. So we have a terrific panel, as we often do. So the purpose, as I mentioned, is to take the long view of the Bush administration, and I guess let me begin by asking Matthew, and then I hope the other panelists will jump in and certainly not stand on ceremony. There is this sense, Matthew, that in the wake of 9/11, going back almost to the beginning of the administration, the president was enormously popular. The Republicans controlled the House. The Democrats had taken control of the Senate, but it was still narrowly divided. There seemed an opportunity for the president to translate this popularity into great success. And at least judging by the polls, by his popularity, the administration has not enjoyed sustained popularity. And certainly in the second term, I think it would be hard to find major domestic policy successes. It seems the American people, in some sense, were disillusioned with the Bush administration after that high point. And you yourself have said that you became somewhat disillusioned with the Bush administration. So what happened? Why was the president not able to translate that enormous boost early in his administration into more sustained popularity or more tangible achievements?
I think you have to take a look a little further back, actually. And I think if you look at when he got elected and then the initial stages of the presidency, of his presidency, people forget that the day before 9/11, George Bush had popularity rating was 50%. His job approval was 50% the day before 9/11 happened. Obviously, the 2 days later, his popularity was 90%. And this is in the aftermath, keep in mind, of having sort of reached across the aisle, Ted Kennedy on No Child Left Behind. He had gotten a number of Democrats to vote for the first round of tax cuts. There were some steps made in that first 9 months that could be told as bipartisan or reaching across the aisle. But his popularity was falling or was diminished from the time of his inauguration until the day before 9/11. And if you look at sort of that window of opportunity, obviously it's one of the, I think most people, I spoke publicly about this, and I think if you took some of the people and gave them truth serum in the White House that are company men or women, they would say that was probably one of the biggest missed opportunities in the last 50 years. A president that had a job approval rating of 90% across all parties, an ability to sort of move the country, transform Washington, do things. And basically, by and large, the country was told to go shopping and get back on airplanes, basically. He was able to maintain those high job ratings for about a year and a half. It took about a year and a half for them to be diminished. Part of the diminishing of it, I think, if you take a look at it, was the Iraq War. The country was much more receptive, obviously, to the war in Afghanistan than they were in Iraq. Initially, they were more receptive in Iraq, but it wasn't long into Iraq that they turned on it and came to the conclusion that it was a failure. But the interesting thing about the president is if you take a look at his numbers, in September of or August of 2005, 4 years almost to the day before 9/11, they were at 50% job approval rating. If you take a look at that, why is he in the place that he is today with his job approval ratings in the mid-30s? A huge part has to be has to do with the tipping point of Katrina. Katrina by itself didn't do it, but it was sort of a tipping point in the country's mind that it just didn't turn out the way this was supposed to do. Government wasn't managed the way they expected it to. Bipartisanship didn't exist. And I think we can have an entire, which we can are happy to do, an entire discussion over why it didn't happen. Interestingly, when I joined with him when he was governor, he did a lot of what he talked about in the campaign about doing, which was working together the lieutenant governor of Texas, which is very unlike California, is very powerful. They appoint all the committees, decide all the legislation. It's more powerful than the governor in Texas, was a Democrat. The Speaker of the House in Texas was a Democrat. And Bush worked with both of them very well, got a lot of stuff done on education and the economy and taxes and many things. Why didn't that happen? Why didn't he live up to the promises of the campaign? Interestingly, I had mentioned this before, I actually think but for Bush, Barack Obama would not exist today but for the Bush presidency. I think the seeds of Barack Obama were sown in the failures of the Bush presidency directly related to the reluctance or inability to bring the country together. I don't think Barack Obama's candidacy could have taken off, and to a degree John McCain's candidacy actually in the Republican primary could have taken off but for the tremendous disappointment that existed about the president and what we want to do. Because if you look back at what Bush said in 99 and 2000, it's very similar to what Barack Obama is saying. It's let's get past the party labels, let's bring the country together, let's do the things that we, let's get the job done, let's not worry about the parties. And he obviously didn't himself follow through on that as well as he could have. There's probably many people to blame for that. But as I've said, he has to take the lion's share of it because he's the leader of the free world. Why he didn't do that in a way that he had done as previously as governor, I think is partly because of the nature of Washington. I think the real problem began in the Bush presidency when the Republicans took over both houses of Congress in 2002, because there was no longer a demand, an inherent demand to cross party lines and get the job. He didn't have to get Democratic votes at that point like he had to when he was governor and like he had to in the first year or year and a half. I actually think he would have been much better off with a Democratic Congress, Democratic Senate and Democratic House. His presidency would have been better off, I think, in the end if that had been the case, because he would have conducted himself, I think, differently. For many reasons, it didn't happen. And I think his presidency, I think his presidency has fallen on his inability to get past the polarized politics that existed when he showed up in Washington.
I agree with Matthew that I think there's a lot you can learn about Bush in the pre-September 11th presidency. But I think you can actually do a harsher reading of it. He's basically elected to do a couple of things. He wants to cut taxes because the issue of the 2000 election was what we're going to do with our fabulous surplus. And he wants to have education reform and, you know, go across the aisle like he did in Texas. He achieves those things very early in his presidency. And in the summer of 2001, he does begin to slide. And he gets into the mid-50s and lower 50s. And I remember doing a story on Bush's polls, and I checked my notes yesterday. I called one Matthew Dowd about it and talked to him, and he said, well, you know, if Bush were going for re-election, because they were thinking about re-election in the summer of 2001, and his ratings were 52 or 53, that would work. Nobody below 47 has ever made it, but if he's at mid-50s, he's okay. But the problem is that Bush didn't really know what he wanted to do after he sort of caught the car. I mean, there was, in late summer and early fall of 2001, they were preparing a series of initiatives which were to be known as, I think it was, communities of character. One of which was made fun of a lot was some sort of initiative in which grandchildren would be encouraged to email their grandparents. And I think one way of reading it is that by September 1st, 2001, Bush really didn't know what to do as president, and he was headed for a meandering and pointless presidency after that. And September 11th gave him something to do. Now, we can talk about, you know, how he messed that up in some ways, but it actually brought out some good things in the sense that, I mean, I personally believe if we make it to January 20th, 2009 without a major or any sort of big terrorist attack in this country, I think Bush will deserve an enormous amount of credit for that. So it did give him, in some ways, a way to shine, but a lot of the domestic weaknesses we've seen of him were there all along because he really didn't have all that much of a reason to be president.
Well, let's talk about how he did respond to 9/11, because that's clearly kind of a defining moment. You see that response. You think he responded very well to that, and you just said deserves a lot of credit if he...
Well, like I said, if he gets to the end of his presidency, I mean, this became... anybody in the executive branch, I mean, with that kind of responsibility, it was an enormous burden on them after September 11th, and I think they bore it up pretty well. I think John Ashcroft bore it up well, and I think people did a good job. Clearly, there's huge failures. I think that the president had a sacred responsibility to kill Osama bin Laden, and he didn't do it. And I think that's an enormous failing. The fact that bin Laden may be alive today, and if he isn't, it's not because Bush didn't get him. So I think that's a huge problem. And then the detour to Iraq, we can talk about that all night. But I think in terms of preventing other terrorist attacks, serious counterterrorism measures. I think he's had a lot of success.
My only, not to go into specific about it, but which is an interesting thing, discussion that people have. It's like, okay, what happens if there's another terrorist attack this year? Well, it's going to help the Republicans because they want a strong leader. Well, what happens if there's not a terrorist attack? Well, it's going to help Republicans because Bush kept the country safe. So it's like whether we have a terrorist attack, it's going to help the Republicans because, to me, we've had more than twice as many people die, soldiers, die in Iraq than died on 9/11. So when we say, well, we haven't had another terrorist attack in this country, we haven't had, well, we've had over 4,000 soldiers die, U.S. soldiers, not to count the Iraqi civilians and not to count other Iraqis, whether we like them or not, other people have died. So I think the country, where the country is, the country doesn't give any award to the president on what he did in Iraq as keeping us safe. The majority of the country thinks we're less safe today, and the majority of the country thinks Iraq was a complete abject failure. It's a rear-view mirror issue to them. They don't even care. They think, okay, the surge worked, and as I said in another forum, the surge to me is like putting a good relief pitcher in when you're 10 runs down and he pitches two good innings and you still lose the game. That's, to me, what the surge. Okay, we had two great innings, and he struck out everybody in two innings, but it doesn't matter. The game's over. And I think, would the Bush's presidency, it's an interesting question, would Bush's presidency be different? I think Byron's exactly right. I think there was a loss. He got two big things done, and then he didn't know what to do with, I'm supposed to be a bipartisan president, and what am I supposed to do after I did this? I agree with that. I think the domestic agenda was lost after those things. But I think there became a calculations of what can help the party in the short-term elections. And I think the next president, honestly, is going to have to make a decision. Is he the leader of the country or is he the leader of his political party? And I think the country is in a place where just because you're a Republican or a Democrat doesn't mean you should be taking out Democrats because they have the D on their back or Republicans because they are on your back. And the idea, I'm going to work with Congress, but oh, by the way, I'm going to have a fundraiser and raise $10 million so I can run ads against some U.S. senator in Minnesota. And I think part of his problem was, whether it was him or other people in the White House, it became a, you know, which naturally happens, it became, how are we going to conduct things so that we can win elections in the short term, which obviously turned out not well for his overall presidency.
I want to direct the question to the two members of the Fourth Estate here about the role of media in this. And as one of two card-carrying historians on the panel, I want to give a little historical background by way of framing the question. And my premise is that the presidency as an institution has evolved a great deal from the time of the founders. And even a glance at the Constitution gives you the cue to this. Article 1, which of the Constitution, which deals essentially with the legislature, has 51 paragraphs in it. And in many places, there is an elision between the legislature or the House or the Senate and the government. The founders clearly thought of the legislature, the two houses of the legislature, as the center of government. Article 2, which deals with the presidency, has just 12 paragraphs in it. And the founders envisioned a political system in which it would be the legislative branch which would have the greater political weight. And indeed, if we cast our minds back over the 19th century, there are some presidencies that loom very large in our collective memory. Jefferson, Jackson, and Lincoln would stand out. But we also remember from the 19th century people like Henry Clay, John C. Calhoun, Thaddeus Stevens, Stephen Douglas, Czar Reed, Uncle Joe Cannon. I mean, there's a whole cast of congressional players whose names are still, at least for even casual students, the matter kind of household words. The 20th century, that something changed. We now define whole eras as the Roosevelt era, the Reagan era, the Truman era, the Clinton era, and so on. And the role of the presidency has transformed quite markedly over the course of the 20th into the 21st century. There's actually a little study of this which tabulated the number of times in the 19th century that the president spoke directly to the people and measured that against what happened in the 19th, between the 19th and 20th centuries. And the tabulation was the president in the 20th century spoke to the people at large six times more frequently than in the 19th century. And conversely, the number of times that the president spoke only to the Congress and not to the public at large has gone down 1/4 over the course of the 20th century. 19th century presidents were four times more likely to speak to the Congress and not the public at large, and 6 times less likely to speak to the public at large. Okay, so what's happened? Well, not least of all is the role of the media, and in particular the emergence of mass electronic media, particularly first the radio and then the television. FDR pioneered the use of the radio, and John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan kind of perfected the techniques of how to use the television. So the factor that you began by mentioning, popularity, this word that we toss around rather casually, but the plebiscitarian character of the presidency, the president's relation to the public at large, is ever larger and more salient in the nature of the institution as time has gone on. So that's the background. Here's the question. If we think of the last several presidencies, let's go back just to FDR. The presidents who are generally regarded as the most successful, Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, and however we finally come up with the historical judgment, Bill Clinton, have all been acknowledged masters of the media that give them maximum leverage on this plebiscitarian, popular character of the office. The presidents who have failed in this era, people like Herbert Hoover and Jimmy Carter, are presidents who never mastered that particular trick. So, to what extent are Bush's problems attributable to his inability to really master the medium that he must master, or any president must master today, to be successful?
You think, can I, before they answer that, can I? So the premise of your question is that Bush is not good on television, to put it bluntly.
That's my premise.
Okay.
I'll take a stab at it. I respectfully disagree. First, hello, everybody. It's good to be back on campus, actually, by the way. I haven't been here in a number of years. And I went by my old house where I lived in Hillegas and Webster. It's still there, but I didn't knock on the door because I didn't know if it would be cool or not. But maybe I will. And boy, did Alter Bates expand in the last 100 years. Anyway.
Playing the Berkeley card.
Yeah.
Anyway. When I came to Washington in 1993 was just really the beginning of the rise of right-wing radio. Then you had Fox News. There is a supportive infrastructure that's there if a White House wanted to use it that never existed from some of these other presidencies. So I don't think there ever was a issue of not having many vehicles to get something out. And then with the rise of the blogosphere, and we're now, I was just talking about whether or not I should Twitter with Brian, you know, if I'm really behind, if I'm just blogging. So there's ways to get stuff out. The issue with President Bush, I think, is the war. It's the policies. It's whether or not you believe the Bush doctrine of preemptive strike is something that the country should be doing. We're at this intersection of history here, and I think the issue of what President Bush does isn't just a matter of communication. I mean, I'm used to dealing with masters of manipulation of message, of you know, the story of the day. When you have a war going on as long as we do, I think there's nothing you can do that can change that storyline. And that is so much. President Bush is going to be judged a lot on how he executed the war. But he has a legacy. He's leaving Judge Roberts on the Supreme Court. He's leaving Judge Alito on the Supreme Court. That's a big one for conservatives. One of his legacy issues that is bipartisan, and I'm wondering what you think of it, is AIDS Africa. And if some of you aren't familiar with it, it was a time where President Bush went against a lot of the conservatives in his party to get this enormous AIDS package through Congress. It was bipartisan. You had a very interesting coalition. I remember Henry Hyde worked with evangelicals to convince some of the Catholic powers to go along with it. So you have these moments, and I would think the AIDS Africa would be one of the stronger ones, but to answer your question, I don't think it's a media issue in this one. It's just the time, the war is such an overshadowing event that I don't know what Bush could do to overcome that.
So in effect, you're saying even Franklin Roosevelt or Ronald Reagan could not have sold this war?
Not the way it has evolved, no.
David, let me turn that back on David. Okay, go ahead and then I'll...
I'm sorry.
before, I think there's this idea that, like, the American public can be fooled by some great, like, some TV ads and a campaign, or we're going to pull the wool over their eyes, and we're going to tell them this, and we're this, and we're really this. The public isn't stupid. The public isn't, the politicians that fail usually are the ones that assume the public's ignorant, and I'm going to tell them something. And a bad war that turned, a war whose premises on which turned out to be totally false, conducted badly, no matter how great a communicator you are, you cannot sell that to the public. There, you cannot improve the situation that's substantively off. I think Bush added to his problems by his inability to bring the country along in a way, in a longer term way, that it wasn't just like, you know, he stood up in front of a podium and, what's going on? Who cares? Or whatever. You know, I think that didn't serve him well. But in the end, I think the country substantively said, this guy ran on this, supposed to have done this, supposed to bring the country together, we're in a war, it's turned out to be a failure, we're done. Disconnect, pull the plug, I'm not paying attention anymore to him. That's where the country is.
I want to go on to the war, but actually let me turn David's question back on him briefly, which is, was the implication of your question that you think that the president's problems have been based in a lack of communication? Do you think, you've written about FDR, for instance, do you think FDR could have communicated, do you think he would have succeeded, notwithstanding the problems in an overseas war and so forth? I mean, do you think that the president's problems have been communicating, or are they fundamentally policy-based?
No, I don't want to be misunderstood as saying that the problems or the historical reputation of the Bush presidency is going to be attributed simply to his cosmetic failures. But it does seem to me that coming out of 9/11, the administration rather quickly mounted a plausible narrative about what the situation was that the country was facing, about the mortal threat of terrorism and so on, and it built that narrative into 90% approval ratings and to a great consensus mobilization for counter-war against terrorism, particularly in Afghanistan, and to a certain extent even the initial stages of Iraq. So my question, I guess, if it has any traction at all, is would a better or more clever communicator have been able to preserve more of that momentum, that consensus, that unifying impulse that came out of 9/11? I think for the reasons that have been discussed, it would have been impossible to preserve all of it because of the way the war went, but could have sustained the narrative about the mortal threat of terrorism and Iraq as an instrument to deal with that in a better fashion than Bush has managed to do. I mean, he's essentially been saying the same thing forever.
Bear it out.
Well, I mean, the substance does matter, and you're absolutely right, it's the most important thing. But Bush can't put two sentences together a lot of the time, and it does hurt. I mean, after September 11th, he gave some great set speeches. A speech, I think it was on September 21st. The National Cathedral was a great speech. Gave a speech in London that was a terrific speech. He did some very, very fine speeches. Speaking extemporaneously, he was often terrible. I'm sure.
Except for the bullhorn.
Everybody
that
who's,
bullhorn moment.
Well, that's right. They're going to hear from all of us. It was a terrific moment. But, I mean, we all have seen these, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, won't get fooled again. Or, you know, people working hard to put food on their families and that kind of, I mean, it's extraordinary at times. And I would want to ask Matthew, because there are people who have gone back and looked at Bush as a public communicator in Texas, where he seemed to be better than he was at some times in his presidency. And one, would you agree with that? And two, if you do, is there a reason? Or...
I think, I mean, part of it is the spotlight is much different than when you're governor of Texas, and what you have to do and how you have to communicate is a much different animal. I mean, you don't really have press conferences as governor in Texas, and, you know, the state's not waiting for you to, like, make some announcements or something. And so I actually think he's improved. If you go back and look at, some of his debate performances in the 94, and some of what things he does, and you go back and look at those things, you would say, God, this guy's gotten a... I mean, I know a lot of people don't believe it, but he's actually got a lot better in that. But the spotlight is so huge, and what the country demands from somebody as president, and I think Bill Clinton did it very well. He could be colloquial, but at the same time speak in full paragraphs and entire sort of streams of thought and carry it through, and I think he did that.
That is a gift. mean, that is extraordinary. When you read a transcript, if any of you, if we could rerun what we've just been doing the last few minutes and look at a transcript of what we've been saying, we have not all been speaking in perfect paragraphs with the beginning, middle, end, right punctuation. When I would read a transcript of Bill Clinton speaking without a script, it would look as if it were a set piece. It was extraordinary. He also had the gift that Bush, when he is on his own, does not, of taking something complex and explaining it simply, which I think is nine-tenths of describing what you do when you're a government official. You don't talk about the low-income heating assistance program called LIHEAP, as in what it's going on with the LIHEAP program. You say, what we want to do as a nation is help people pay their heating costs. Here's what I want to do. And Bush sometimes is there. Clinton always was there in being able to do that.
I think one of the things, and I think this is all part of it, but one of the things I think in the post 9/11 atmosphere, I think what the country wanted was a call to a common participation in something. And what they were told was, I will handle this. I will handle this. You go shopping and go get on airplanes and go do all that stuff and keep the economy going. And there wasn't a we. There wasn't a we. There wasn't, okay, let's all get war bonds. Let's all we're in this together. We're gonna bring it. We're not gonna just have a voluntary military. We're gonna have, everybody's got a stake in this. And there, he did not, the country wanted to have a chit in the game.
Can I just dramatize that moment? I went, there's an institution in Washington called the Sperling Breakfast. The Christian Science Monitor sponsors these high-calorie breakfasts. Karl Rove was at the breakfast. There's a newsmaker, and the war had started, and somebody asked something like, what should we be doing? And that would have made a good story. Karl Rove, top advisor to the president, says we should be planting victory gardens or don't drive as much, save oil. People wanted to be involved, and he said, the president wants you to go about your day and go shopping. And I have a whole list of stories I wish I would have handled differently, or a column, I don't remember if I was a columnist then, or just the idea that we were starting a war and no one was asked to do anything in particular different in their life.
Remember the beginning of Iraq or Afghanistan?
This was the Global War on Terror, which I thought as a branding name was a little off too, if you had anything to do with that.
You're talking
post 9/11. This is post 9/11.
But pre-Iraq,
I believe, is when it happened. But it's still the point. We went from one war to another. Whatever it is, we still were involved in a conflict.
Can I bring in David? Yeah.
There's a structural issue here that's really kind of a tough nut. And if we take this story up to and through the Iraq episode, and you ask the question, what sort of quote-unquote sacrifice and participation through the means of sacrifice could this or any president plausibly have asked for? It's a very short list. In fact, it may be a null set. And it has to do with the composition of the military force we have, the role or the relative place or weight of the military in the economy that we have, and the kind of warfare that we're actually engaged in, counterinsurgency warfare. We have an all-volunteer force. It's got 1.4 million active members. Relative to population, that's about 3 or 4% of the force that we fielded in World War II. The Defense Department budget, even with the supplemental appropriations for Iraq and Afghanistan, is about a little over 4% of GDP. In World War II, it was 40%. We fought a different kind of war in that era that demanded, required, absolutely obligated, massive public participation, both psychologically and economically. We don't have to fight that kind of war anymore. We are in a situation where we can wage very, very aggressive military action out there without ever breaking a sweat in our domestic society, either demographically in terms of people who participate in the armed forces or economically in terms of the overall weight of this operation given a $14 trillion economy. So if you'd been in the Oval Office and said, President Bush, we need you to suggest some sacrifice, what would he have nominated?
Well, Matthew, you were there. What should he have said?
First of all, whether or not you needed it substantively to conduct the war, which I think as of today, I think you could argue you needed it, because we've now spent whatever the number, right number is, close to $1 trillion, running huge deficits. We're not able to deal with some of the fundamental weaknesses that we have in society, healthcare, structural weaknesses in the country that have now been lost because we didn't even rescind tax cuts to fight the global war on terror that was the most important war in 100 years. We didn't even sort of do any of that. What we could have done, I mean, there's a long list of things. We could have asked local communities to, you know, sponsor things in their community for the soldiers that had gone. We could have called the country to a national service, to national service. And whether that is a military national service or we want every person that's of some age to volunteer, whether it's go to Africa or do something or something, we could have called the country to a sense of national service. We could have asked the country to invest in bonds, war bonds that would have paid for this so that we didn't incur the deficits that we've incurred over the course of this. It doesn't substantively, the substance per se isn't as important as the president never got the country when they wanted it to put a stake in the game. They never got a stake in the game. They thought, I'm just going to pay my taxes, I'm just going to sit in my chair, and I don't really do anything because the sheriff up in Washington is going to handle all of this. And when you don't do that, you reap the problem that all of a sudden the country says it's a mistake. It's your mistake. It's no longer our mistake because we're all in this. It's your mistake, George W. Bush, because you did it on your own. And that's what happens.
And did you make the argument to him at the time that he should ask for that sacrifice? And if so, what did he say?
I didn't make the argument directly to him. I made the argument a number of times to a number of people that would have had the access to make that argument directly to him.
And what was the response?
The response was, we got it handled, Matthew. Don't worry about that, basically. I have brothers and sisters that called me up in the aftermath of 9/11 and said, what can we do? I had a brother who was in the Coast Guard for 20 years and wanted to re-enlist in the Coast Guard after retiring from it. And, you know, he tried to contact local people. Nobody's like, no, we don't need anything. We got it handled. Don't worry about it. There was probably, you know, the vast majority of the country would have done something. And then they would have had a stake in the game. And then as the process, first of all, it would have made the president more accountable to it, because then he had to sort of bring the country along on it, and then he would have to be accountable for the mistakes along the way, and then say what he was going to do differently. But two, the country wouldn't have gone against him as much, because it would have been about we and not just about him.
How much of that response, or non-response, do you think was informed by what I'm going to call the mission accomplished psychology? That is to say that the administration expected the duration of this engagement, whatever it was going to be rather short, and you didn't need to mobilize the public because the episode would be behind us before we knew it.
You know what I think it is, and I don't mean to be psychoanalyze the president, but I'm going to. I think the president, in his heart, when he said, I'm going to take this burden on myself and I'm not going to ask people to do it and I'm going to do this because this is going to be my presidency and this is going to be on me and I'm going to do it myself. And I actually think there's part of a sort of a Texas Western sort of thing, you know, the Texas Ranger, you know, one Ranger, one riot, I'll go in and take care of stuff and walk out of town and do that. I think part of it is that's part of his who he is. It's like the old big male figure, I can handle this, I'll do it, the country needs to, they need to go about their stuff and do the thing, and they don't need to worry about this, I'll worry about this. I don't think that was done in maliciously. I think he lost a huge opportunity. I think he didn't recognize that you have to, in something like that, the country has to be involved in it. But he thought, I can do it myself, I'll get it done myself, I'll carry this weight on my own. I think that was more of it than anything else.
High noon.
High noon.
Yeah.
Byron, did you want to get in on sort of the tone of his...
Look, I think 100% of his problems was he didn't win.
Talking about in Iraq.
Yeah, if the action in Afghanistan went as it did, and he goes into Iraq, he fits some definition of victory within a year or so. Let's say the number of Americans who have died now had died in that year in which the United States won the war, he'd be fine. You start a war of choice, you convince people you got to do it, you got to win. And that's the only problem. And the world will be a happier place.
And
the White House would be a happier place if he had just done it.
Do the rest of you agree
to convince people that it is not a war of choice? It's a a war where we have no choice but to do this.
Well, he tried to do that, but I mean, people were, I mean, he, what was the approval for the war? It was in the 60s or 70s?
60s.
Okay, right when it starts. So, I mean, he doesn't convince everybody even at the time. And then a few months later, when there are no weapons of mass destruction, you know, the slide starts. But the important thing was victory. And maybe it's callous to say, but the American people would not care how many Iraqis died. They would not care about the doctrine, the corrosive doctrine of preemptive war. They wouldn't care about any of this stuff if the war were just won and over.
And you said earlier that you thought he actually should get credit for the response to 9/11, if you will, separate from Iraq.
Yeah.
If Iraq had gone well, you think he would be getting more of that?
Boy, that's a hell of a counterfactual. he would. Yeah, of course, he would be getting a ton of credit for this.
Do the others of you agree that that's that we've talked a lot about his communication strategies? But is Byron right that that's the fundamental problem with the Bush administration and with his?
No, but you can't. Okay,
is Iraq?
Let's take a step back. Let's just take a little step back and say, how did we end up in the middle of a war that turns out wasn't winnable and was based on faulty information? Well, how did that happen? Not like whether or not we could have won the war, but what precipitated, everybody was fine in Afghanistan, it was all a war of revenge. We can have a long discussion whether or not that's proper, but it was a war of revenge, basically. And so everybody was bought into that, and then we go into Iraq, and in the country's mind, it's all the same. It's like Iraq, Afghanistan, it's all a bunch of people over there that they're going to do stuff to us badly. And how did we, the question is how did we get in a position that we engaged in a war that was both unwinnable and based upon complete, total, faulty information? That is a more important question.
I will take their side here for a moment. There was rational thought that went into it. There was a bipartisan consensus across administrations that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Bill Clinton couldn't get too angry about it because he believed it. The members of Congress who passed the Iraqi Liberation Act couldn't get too agitated about it because they believed it. And there was, if you would ask the Bush people, there were different ways to read intelligence, and you can read it in an alarmist way or a non-alarmist way. And before September 11th, a lot of it was read in a non-alarmist way, and they began to read it in a very alarmist way. I'm just making the case that you could follow a rational thought process and get there.
Saying that, you know, somebody like said, oh, we're going to go create a bunch of stuff and we're going to go like get in a war, and we don't, it's not true. We're going to go do this. I don't think that was the case. I think that the belief was exactly what you thought. But the problem is how did we get in that? How did we get in the position where there was a bias at almost every single level in the government, extending past the Bush administration, previous to the Bush administration, where we were not able to identify what would happen? This wasn't just like a war, and then all of a sudden we went into a war, and there was like 100,000 more troops than we thought. This was at its most fundamental basis, extending from a Democratic administration to a Republican administration, though the Bush administration launched the war. How did we get in the position where that happened? That's my question. I don't think he, of course, if he would have won the war, he'd be riding high and everything would be great and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, that obviously was a fiction. How did we end up in that place? How did we end up in that place? That at every level of government, that we ended up making decisions based upon information that was totally wrong.
And also, you have to understand, there were other reasons that the Bushies wanted to do this. Bush gives a speech at the American Enterprise Institute dinner, when did the war begin? March 3rd? In mid-February, he gives a speech, and it's all about remaking the Middle East. It's all about one of the ex post facto reasons that came out after the lack of weapons of mass destruction, there were several reasons, and I think Paul Wolfowitz later tells Sam Tannenhaus, who was at that time writing for Vanity Fair, that there were a whole bunch of reasons, and it's kind of like everybody wanted to go to a war for their own reason, and they decided that weapons of mass destruction was the best. It could convince the most people. There was a series of UN resolutions that Saddam had ignored. There was a history there, and so that's what they went with. But they felt, and then Bush may have had some thing going on, and it's wanting to get rid of Saddam. He certainly tells David Frum, the speechwriter, writes in his memoir that Bush meets with the speechwriters in February of 2001, goes through some of his policy goals. One of those goals is to, I think Frum said, dig Saddam Hussein out of power in Iraq. Doesn't necessarily mean war, but get him out of there. So this is a goal, you know, that's been around well before September 11th.
I suspect that the judgment of history will be substantially in agreement with what you just said. And I'm recollecting a famous remark of Dean Acheson's in his memoir when he talks about the onset of the Korean War. And he uses this really rather colorful phrase. He said, the Korean War saved us in the sense that it created the political space to implement this famous national security doctrine outlined in this document called NSC 68 to put the country on a quasi-war footing to take the Defense Department budget up to 10% of GDP, 50% of the federal budget. And there we have the 1950s, and we have the implementation of the containment doctrine. But Korea was just the occasion to actually make that political decision and be able to sell it. And in some ways, I strongly suspect that the final judgment of history will be 9/11, in a sense, was like Korea. It opened the political space to accomplish something in that region that there a lot of people were interested in doing, changing the political equation, the political culture of the region, getting rid of the oil shocks, getting rid of issues of Israeli national security, and incidentally, throttling down international terrorism. But that the basic philosophical geostrategic aspiration was there before 9/11.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk a little about domestic policy, because we've talked a lot about foreign policy here. Byron, you talked earlier about tax cuts and No Child Left Behind in the first term.
The meandering and pointless presidency.
In the second term, it becomes more meandering. There's no domestic policy achievements at all, really.
Something very interesting happens. He gets reelected because on a national security election, I think there's no doubt that voters decided it was just not safe enough. You can either say it's not safe enough to change horses or not safe enough to elect a Democrat, whichever. And he gets reelected, and then he devotes the next 6 to 8 months trying to reform Social Security while Iraq begins to burn. And there are people inside the administration who say, we're not paying enough attention to this, and he's out there pushing this plan every day, which, you know, the Democrats had pronounced dead on arrival, and it was. And then he does that and spends most of 2005 doing it. And then 2006, Iraq is horrible. And he ends up getting defeated in November, which finally kicks his butt to do the surge. But I remember I was in a group of maybe 8 journalists, they were all conservatives, meet with him in late October of 06, so just before the defeat. He's still talking benchmarks all the time. But it was clear. I mean, he had no idea what to do. I mean, it was really troubling. And I had been in a similar meeting with him in late 03, in which there were certainly doubts about the war by that time, maybe December of 03. But he was really sharp, had focused, could communicate very well. I came out like, remember all those Democrats who would say, oh, you know, Al Gore is really, he's very warm and funny in private, and he's very stiff in public. But I came out and I thought Bush was terrific from this. And in October of 06, he just didn't seem to have a clue. Not that anyone else had a clue either. And it's only his losing in November that gives him a new way to operate, and which he's been, I think, amazingly successful for a guy at 30% who just lost both houses of Congress.
What are you saying? He has congressional successes?
He was reduced to the core powers of the presidency. He can veto things, and he's the commander in chief, and that has been enough. If there was any message of that 06 election, it was to get out of Iraq. And between the time of the election and the time the Democrats were sworn in, he changed the question from get out of Iraq to how many more troops are we going to send? It was an astonishing act of political skill.
You also got those two Supreme Court appointments.
That was in 05.
Yeah.
I just want to point out, too, in some of his big congressional initiatives, you know, if we're trying to make a record here, Social Security initiative, just what it did was give the Democrats a marvelous opportunity to organize and test run a lot of systems that you're seeing now in at least in the Obama campaign. Some of the people involved were involved in the Save Social Security. Immigration, something that Bush thought he could work across the aisle on, has not been done, probably won't be done by the day he leaves office. And stem cell research, just to have another one that he thought would be a signature issue. That was a first term thing, kind of hanging out there, no movement on it. The other thing, didn't we just have the S-CHIP? The children's health insurance. So some of these epic.
Well, we should mention prescription drugs.
For him,
so this is a big success.
All right, they did. Okay, so you score him on that.
We score him
on AIDS. That he did have some, but you know, in covering Congress these past years, it is almost a wave. It's not just 10 things going on at once. It's these campaigns within these campaigns that have so marked the how Congress has been working. If you wonder sometimes, I wonder sometimes for people who just consume the news, when you read every day, for months on end, there's an immigration story, and then one day the story just ends because people just said, we can't make a deal, it's over. Do you know what it's like to have your story leave you?
Byron, I just wanted to make sure, earlier when you said that he, at the beginning of the second term, he spent 6 or 8 months talking about Social Security reform, while Iraq is going to pot. Are you suggesting that had he not, that there was an opening there, had he paid more attention to Iraq, had he not, that things could have been better, and that...
Well, he was in, you know, part of the inarticulateness problem with him, he would just come out and say, it's hard work. And that was no good in a public relations sense, and it was no good in a policy sense either, and I personally think it took him losing both houses of Congress to actually change his strategy. But there were people telling him to change his strategy, to send more troops, to take care of this problem to the degree that it could be. We may disagree about that. But through 2005 and 2006, he didn't do it.
David, can I ask you, is the lack of domestic policy achievements here, does it stand out compared to other presidents historically? There have been relatively few periods of major domestic policy achievement. The system is sort of built against it, really.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a constitutional system that is purpose-built because of the founders' fear of concentrated power wherever it might be found, that we have a system that's very, very difficult to manipulate. It's not a parliamentary system. We divide. The famous checks and balances is a formula for political paralysis, and it works pretty well. It achieves its objectives pretty well. So there's relatively few moments, particularly over the course of the 20th century, when President and Congress have collaborated sufficiently to really change the institutional and political landscape. And the New Deal's a big one. The Reagan years are another one. Woodrow Wilson. That's about it. I mean, there really aren't a lot.
The questions are a little, there's a little Berkeley bias here. Will George W. Bush go down as the worst president in American history? That's a couple of them. Nobody asked if he'll go down as the best. Will he go down as the worst president since Buchanan? Let me edit that a little and just say, how will he be viewed in the long run of history? Byron?
Well, part of it depends on how Iraq turns out. I don't know what's going to happen. There's potential for great disaster, and it could be in 10 years. It could be a better situation. I don't know. He bet the bank on it. Katrina certainly will be a terrible mark on his presidency, and although it was worse for Ray Nagin, but my feeling is that he's worst president. No, but this was one of the most consequential presidencies we've seen in a long time, simply because of events that Bush had no control over. In terms of, I'm not going to go the full Truman. But we do have to see how this stuff turns out.
Lynn, how do you think you'll be remembered?
I agree with Brian. You have to, it's just too soon, and a lot depends on how Iraq turns out. A lot depends if we're attacked again before he leaves office. And I think those, without knowing that, it's just, you know, I deal in the day-to-day. These big view questions are real tough for me.
Matthew?
I think some of it depends on Iraq, but I think he's going to go, I don't think he'll be viewed as the worst president in history, in the history of this country. But I think he will be viewed, no matter what happens in Iraq, as a president that was given some huge opportunities and missed them. Some huge opportunities and that other presidents have not been given and did, for whatever reason, was not able to take advantage of them. So not the worst, but a huge missed opportunity presidency.
David, you're the Pulitzer Prize winning historian up here.
So?
So you should have an opinion.
Well, look, as you know, and I'm sure many others in this room do as well, every few years there's one of these polls of hundreds of historians about who they think are the best and the worst presidents. And there actually, over time, there's quite a degree of consistency in these things. And there's a set of people who always end up occupying the basement. It's Warren G. Harding and Ulysses Grant, usually on grounds of their presidencies were notoriously corrupt. And James, I believe the correct pronunciation actually is Buchanan, and Andrew Johnson, because the one failed to avert the Civil War and the other botched the aftermath of the Civil War. So that quartet always ends up in the bottom. So if you really want to ask, is Bush going to be go down as the worst president, you got to judge him in that particular company. Sean Wilentz, an historian at Princeton, wrote a piece in, of all places, Rolling Stone about a year and a half ago in which he tried to make the case that Bush will go down as the worst ever. I didn't find it a particularly persuasive article, frankly. But if you ask what are the possible consequences of the Bush presidency, a long-term, enduring, general foreign policy problem that goes back to the decay of these multilateral institutions and our leadership role in them, what looks to be long-term, perhaps even greater turmoil in the Middle East than would have obtained before our intervention, an economy that looks like it's going to come out of his presidency in not very good shape, failure to deal with, the very urgent issue of immigration. I mean, the list is pretty long of things that they're not merely missed opportunities. Iraq in particular was an opportunity of his making. So I think there's a strong possibility that the ultimate judgment of history is that he belongs down in the basement with those four characters, and maybe even he comes in below them.
Next year we'll be back with a new president to talk about. In the meantime, my thanks to the panel, Byron York, Lynn Sweet, Matthew Dowd, and David Kennedy. Thank you and good night.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.